Omaha Public Radio presents another program from the Durham Museum Lecture Series on Noon Forum. In a special program commemorating the 71st anniversary this Friday of the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor on December 7, 1941, we'll hear a talk by Dan Sullivan, the editor for World Herald Books, including At War, At Home, World War II, as well as his upcoming book in the At War, At Home series that will focus on the Cold War years, including Korea, Vietnam, and the Strategic Air Command. He'll talk about the commitment and sacrifice of Nebraskans and Western Iowans who helped the nation defeat the Axis powers. This program, part of The American Soldier, From the Civil War to the War in Iraq, a photographic tribute, on display now through Sunday, January 6th at the Durham Museum, was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday evening, October 30th, 2012, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the Durham Museum, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Mick Hale, Director of Education at the Durham Museum.
We are very fortunate to have two very powerful exhibits on display this fall in the Velde Hall of American History. Both The American Soldier and Worn with Pride have been highly received by our visitors and has created inspiring dialogue amongst all of our guests, many of whom are veterans. We are especially proud of Worn with Pride as our exhibits and curatorial teams put that magnificent exhibit together with the help of many gracious partners. There are a number of people and organizations whose support makes these kinds of exhibitions and programming possible, and I want to take a moment to quickly acknowledge their generosity. We're very fortunate tonight to have two of those sponsors join us, Howard and Rhonda Hawks. Thank you very much for your support of the exhibit and the programming. Also sponsoring the exhibitions, the Douglas County Commissioners, Peter Kiewit Sons, Valmont Industries, HDR, Ann and Ken Stinson, the Dr. C.C. and Mabel L. Chris Memorial Foundation, the Dillon Foundation, the Mammal Foundation, Pat and Dick Bell, Fraser Stryker, U.S. Bank, John and Mary Wilson, and the David Scott Foundation. Please once again join me in thanking our sponsors. Our guest this evening, Dan Sullivan, is the editor for World Herald Books and has been with the newspaper for more than 35 years with roles in news, sports, and business. Tonight, Dan shares with us the compelling story of At War, At Home, World War II, a look at the commitment and sacrifice of Nebraskans and Western Iowans who helped the nation defeat the Axis powers. This part of the country provided unique assistance to the war effort through aircraft and munitions manufacturing, pilot training, and housing of enemy prisoners. In addition, the Omaha World Herald initiated a scrap metal drive that was used as the model nationwide during a time when the nation suffered from serious shortages of materials needed for armaments. He has just finished the next book in the At War, At Home series that will focus on the Cold War years, including Korea, Vietnam, and the Strategic Air Command. The At War, At Home series is available in the Durham Museum shop. Ladies and gentlemen, Dan Sullivan. Thank you, Dan.
Thank you. I'm very grateful to be here at the Durham Museum and to be part of the tribute to the American soldier. We're going to talk tonight about World War II, a war that uniquely tested not only American troops, but also the American civilian population. The Omaha World Herald last year marked the 70th anniversary of the attack on Pearl Harbor with At War, At Home, World War II. As Mick said, a special look back at Nebraskans and Iowans who helped the nation win the war. It's said that newspapers are the first rough draft of history. We combine daily details of the war years through World Herald archives along with the perspective gained in the decades since the war ended. We especially wanted to highlight the coverage from our overseas correspondents. Lawrence Youngman reported from England and France in 1944. Bill Bellotti headed to the Pacific in 1945. Both were witness to monumental events during the war. But they did more than that for World Herald readers. They also sent home snapshots of the boys away at war and provided updates on what they were doing. Our book contains stories of Nebraskans and Iowans, and we hope that they will provide a much deeper and richer understanding of this important period. Generals Dwight Eisenhower and George Patton are in this book, but so are your neighbors and maybe your relatives, and they're the ones who will bring the story of World War II home to you. We begin on the morning of December 7th, 1941, not in Hawaii, but on doorsteps in Nebraska and western Iowa. The Sunday World Herald carried two stories that day about the growing threat of war in the Pacific. The lead story told that Japanese convoys were steaming toward Southeast Asia and that 125,000 Japanese troops were concentrated in Indochina. Later that Sunday, radios began crackling with news of the attack on Pearl Harbor. More than 90 ships were at anchor when the Japanese struck the U.S. Pacific Fleet. The United States would now join a war that Europe had been fighting for more than 2 years. The survivors of the sneak attack formed a unique group, and they bore witness to the first sparks of the war. Ed Guthrie of Omaha was aboard the USS Whitney. "It was something you couldn't believe," he said. "The water was black with diesel fuel. People in the water came out like they were coated in tar. It was chaos. Nobody knew what to do. Afterward, I was assigned to a boat, and we spent 4 days picking up wounded, dead, and whatever out of the water." Omahans gathered downtown to listen to radio broadcasts at a storefront along the north side of Farnham between 16th and 17th Streets. Scarcely had the first bulletins gone out over the radio than the World Herald was flooded with calls from people with relatives in the Pacific. Readers received details the next morning of the damage and reports that 350 were known dead. That total would swell to more than 2,400. There was also news of attacks on the Philippines and Singapore. I wish I could report that the World Herald was always the voice of calm during this dark time. Unfortunately, however, we ran this map showing routes for enemy bombers to reach downtown Omaha. Now, in our defense, it was a U.S. Army presentation, and we did accurately report it. And Omaha was eventually bombed, but not until 1945, and that was when a Japanese balloon exploded over Dundee, causing no damage. Young Nebraskans and Iowans immediately volunteered to serve and headed off to war. Robert Miller of Omaha recalled that he was at the recruiting office as soon as he heard the news of Pearl Harbor, but it was Sunday. He came back on Monday when the office was open. This scene is from a train depot in Grand Island, just 3 weeks after Pearl Harbor. That sort of youthful exuberance was replaced by the grim reality of war. It's hard now to imagine the gloom that would have settled upon the country in late 1941 and early 1942 as bodies began arriving home for burial. World Herald editorial at the end of the war looked back at this time and noted, "Many of us thought the blackness of doom was closing over our civilization. But beneath the grim surface, the character of Americans was unwavering. And by the time that long, hard winter was over, Nebraskans and Iowans were ready to show that they would answer the call. They would serve, and they would sacrifice." 60,000 came out on a chilly April morning to celebrate Army Day, an observance that had begun after World War I. The highlight of the parade was the Army's 4th Cavalry, which, as it turned out, was on its final march. The cavalry headed to Fort Robinson immediately afterwards and was disbanded. Was turned into a mechanized armor unit, and later served in Europe. The crowd stood 10 deep in spots, with Nebraskans and Iowans eager to cheer on their men in uniform. Spirit was alive. Those who were not bound for service were ready to do their part on the home front. Marshaling troops was a minor problem, however, compared to committing the civilian population to all-out war. So while the U.S. was hardly defenseless at the beginning of the war, it had not been prepared for a sudden attack, and especially one that would commit the nation to fighting a war on two fronts. World Herald publisher Henry Dorley was exasperated by attempts to get willing citizens organized to meet the need for scrap metal for munitions, planes, and tanks. In the summer of 1942, Dorley added the vital ingredient that had been missing, competition. He concocted a contest that would pit Nebraska counties against each other and collecting scrap metal. The tally would be tabulated on a per-person basis. The winning county was to receive $2,000 in war bonds donated by the World Herald. The effort began at the grassroots level, with individual members of the community collecting and donating every piece of metal they could find. Community groups then organized the individuals, and local governments organized the groups. The success caught on. The nation gave its attention to it, and the effort was expanded to every state. The response was overwhelming. Old pianos, washtubs, lamps, car parts, bicycles, you name it. Everything was donated. A lot at 10th and Jackson Streets, which is just down at the bottom of the viaduct over here, was filled, emptied, and filled again. For its efforts in organizing the scrap metal drive, the World Herald won the 1943 Pulitzer Prize for Public Service. And if you're wondering who won in Nebraska, it was Grant County, with 638 pounds of metal per person. Dorley had been right, and communities were eager to show up their neighbors down the road. Further sacrifice was needed on the home front in the form of rationing. Within months of Pearl Harbor, the War Production Board had instructed Americans on a complex system of stamps, tokens, and books. Food, coffee, gas, rubber, they were all limited. Everyone was expected, as the slogan went, to make do or do without. Americans did without meat and sugar. They made do with creative stitchwork that could get extra wear out of their clothing, and that would keep textile mills busy with uniforms for the military. Rich, poor, it didn't matter. As Marie Merriman of Loup City, Nebraska put it, even if you had money, you couldn't buy anything. At one point, bakers quit slicing bread to help it stay fresher longer. That way, less would go to waste. So for consumers during the war, rationing was the worst thing since sliced bread. Sorry. Americans actually ended up with a fairly healthy diet during the war because they reduced the meat and sugar they used. They cut back dramatically and started eating their vegetables. Victory gardens sprang up in every spare area that could be planted. Didn't matter where you lived, there was always a patch of ground available. This garden provided vegetables on land donated by the Burlington Railroad at 2nd and Poppleton Streets, which is about a mile from here. The nation's farms, meanwhile, increased production by 25%, and this was in spite of a 17% drop in manpower due to the war. But supplying troops wasn't enough. Morale was just as important as any product the public could provide. And USO centers opened across Nebraska and Iowa, mostly near military bases, and also along major rail routes where the men would be traveling to ship out. Volunteers supplied the centers. The Junior Red Cross at Rosewater School in 1 month donated 250 kolaches, 200 dozen cookies, and 40 cakes. They were handed out right here at Union Station. But no place showed hospitality better than North Platte, whose legendary canteen provided a touch of home to lonesome servicemen who stopped in central Nebraska. Canteen workers served up sandwiches, deviled eggs, coffee, and birthday cakes to up to 8,000 troops a day. All of the food was donated from residents of nearby towns, and don't forget, they also were undergoing rationing. One veteran years later recalled the canteen women waving goodbye from the North Platte station. They made us feel like heroes. Social events also were organized around nearby military bases to boost morale. The nation's entertainers stepped forward, including orchestra leader Glenn Miller, who was born in Clarinda, Iowa, and grew up, spent 10 years in western Nebraska. Miller disbanded his big band at the height of his career and at age 38 enlisted and formed a military orchestra. And where there was music, there was dancing. On a personal note, my father, who was a city slicker from Brooklyn, New York, met my mother, an Iowa farm girl, at a dance at Fort Omaha. My dad at the time was stationed at the Army Air Base at Fairmont, Nebraska, and my mom was working at a war plant in Council Bluffs. They were married in Paris, Texas. Nebraskans were able to see that their scrap metal was being put to use. The state was home to the huge Martin Bomber plant located at Offutt Air Base in Bellevue. The nation went from double-digit unemployment in the 1930s to manpower shortages in 1942 as the men went off to war. But by 1943, women made up about 40% of the workforce at Nebraska defense plants. Hildreth Madsen of Bellevue said she thought of her brothers who were away at war as she worked at the Martin plant. I felt like every rivet I put in had better be done right. By 1944, more than 18,000 women were estimated to be employed at war plants just in the Omaha area. And at its peak, more than 14,000 worked at the Martin plant, which churned out an incredible number of aircraft. Among the planes produced were B-26 Marauders, some of which were rushed in 1942 to take part in the Battle of Midway. And, of course, the plant also produced B-29 Super Fortresses, which helped quicken the end of the war in the Pacific. President Franklin Roosevelt visited the plant in 1943 and saluted the work that was being done at the Aircraft Assembly Building. The workers earned that praise. They worked 12 and even 16-hour shifts to meet the demand for military aircraft. The Aircraft Assembly Building was more than 1 million square feet, which was big enough to handle FDR's Buick. Other big employers were the munitions facilities at Meade, Grand Island, Hastings, and Sydney. The work was incredibly hazardous, as you can imagine, by looking at these women who were cramming liquid TNT into bombs. The safety record was good, considering, but it wasn't spotless. 4 explosions at the Hastings Navy Depot in 1944 killed 21 workers and caused a school roof to collapse in nearby Harvard, injuring 21 children. But the production at the plants was as amazing as it was hazardous. The plant in Meade produced more than 3 million bombs. The Hastings Depot produced 40% of the U.S. Navy's ammunition during the war. And that was a huge facility, covering 78 square miles. You couldn't escape the war. It was everywhere. It changed day-to-day life and transformed the landscape of Nebraska and Iowa. Racing at Exarban was suspended, and the grounds were turned into an Army vehicle depot. In 1944, the Women's Army Corps assembled what at that time was called the first all-woman truck convoy. Women were the drivers, and women were in command. They looked pretty proud. WACS at Exarban also performed maintenance and did body work on vehicles, and this work was done at the Coliseum at Exarban. Nebraska also was home to 11 Army airfields that trained fighter, bomber, and glider crews. Paratroopers drilled for D-Day in the Sand Hills and along the Pine Ridge by Fort Robinson. Now, if you're curious as to why military air training was done in Nebraska, there were two reasons. One was we were situated so far from either coast, the Pentagon figured it would be tough for foreign spies to get here. And second, the wide open spaces of outstate Nebraska were sparsely populated, and that limited the damage from crashes during training. Sadly, more than 220 airmen died from crashes in Nebraska. It was a lethal combination of youthful exuberance and the rush to get planes to the war fronts as quickly as possible. More than 7,000 aircraft were lost in accidents over the United States during the war, and that was about 50% more than were lost in the war against Japan in the Pacific. In fact, General Curtis LeMay said it was safer to fly a B-29 over Japan than it was to take a training flight in the States. Nebraskans who live near the air bases acknowledged the danger of the frequent crashes, but what they didn't bargain for was being bombed by American planes. The village of Tarnoff, which is near Columbus, was hit by a pair of B-17s who unloaded their bombs at about 4 o'clock one morning. Luckily, the bombs were filled with sand rather than explosives, and nobody was hurt. But there was something to talk about in Tarnoff the next day. Communities in Nebraska and Iowa also had prisoner of war camps nearby, and they employed German and Italian captives at local farms and businesses. This is the German theater at the POW camp at Fort Robinson. The marquee sign reads, "Enjoy life." Some of the prisoners developed good relationships with local communities and returned to live in Nebraska after the war. One farmer said the barriers of the war came down around the dinner table. As one German prisoner told him, "Democracy begins in the stomach." Fort Robinson also was home to a large training facility for military dogs. The canine units were not designed for combat, but rather for guard duty, and that would free up troops for combat. And believe it or not, 32 breeds were originally accepted for service, but they eventually weeded it down to 8, and those were the more traditional sentry dogs, such as German Shepherds. Chihuahuas were designated 4F. Shows were staged to demonstrate the nation's military might to the civilians, including this Army War Show at the Creighton Football Stadium in Omaha. The war had forced Creighton to end its football program in 1942, and the school never revived it. Nebraska had gone to the 1941 Rose Bowl, but during the war, NU didn't use military trainees, as some schools did. As a result, the Huskers suffered through miserable seasons during the war and were unable to reestablish themselves as a football power until Bob Devaney arrived in 1962. The tide began to turn in the war against Japan with victories at Guadalcanal and Midway. And with the outlook improving in Europe, Americans began arriving in England to prepare for the invasion of France. The Allies also began to clear the Germans and Italians from the Mediterranean theater. These Omaha soldiers served in North Africa and later in Italy as the noose began to tighten on Nazi Germany. An Iowa National Guard unit made its mark with the Red Bull Division and engaged in heavy fighting in Italy, thus tying down German troops so they couldn't fight in France. Charles Radford of Glenwood said, "We were a forgotten unit, but we did what we had to do." The British, who had been at war for 5 years, welcomed the Yanks in 1944. Americans in training became a common sight in the countryside, and many were housed in English homes. One English woman made her home available to two American soldiers, including one from Cherokee, Iowa. She wrote this poem in the spring of 44 as they departed. "They marched down the road with a laugh and a wave, those two boys of mine, so young and so brave. Oh, how I missed them, and often I'd pray, for I knew what was coming, the dreaded D-Day." D-Day marked the beginning of the end for Nazi Germany, and June 6 remains one of our nation's most important dates. The size of the operation was colossal. Nearly 7,000 ships and landing craft and 12,000 planes that got 150,000 troops into France on the first day. Columbus, Nebraska native Andrew Higgins designed and built the Higgins boats that you see here. Dwight Eisenhower later called the Higgins boats the key to victory. More than 6,000 Americans gave their lives on the longest day with the bloodiest fighting at Omaha Beach. Omahans were there. Roger McCarthy described the scene. "I was 20 on the beach, and I had no idea what we were getting into. It was a shock to see the death. The impression was that somebody screwed this up. This wasn't how it was supposed to be." The origin of the name Omaha Beach was a mystery for years, but an answer might have been found in 2003 when the family of the late Gail Eiler of Omaha found his written account of service in the war. He wrote of working with a Utah man as carpenters for General Omar Bradley in England in 1944. Eiler said that Bradley, who had helped plan D-Day, named Omaha and Utah beaches after the pair of carpenters to reward them for their quick work in putting his headquarters together in England. And while Eiler's story could not be verified, and we did try, the facts do fit, and historians say it's at least a plausible explanation. World Herald correspondent Lawrence Youngman arrived in London on June 5th. He heard the news of the invasion the next morning from an elevator operator at the hotel. While in England, he reported from air bases and followed the training of the former Nebraska National Guard unit that had become the 134th Infantry. He didn't neglect the hometown coverage, even though he was witness to major events during the war. One day, he climbed to the top of a cliff to photograph a group of Nebraska soldiers who were down below. He had them spell out N-E-B. He also reported on the Nebraskans' leisure activities and took pictures of them as they visited tourist attractions in England. But as time grew nearer for the 134th to head to France, the stories became more serious. General Dwight Eisenhower reviewed the Nebraska troops on parade in late June 1944, and they were ashore in France a few days later. The Battle of Saint-Lô was among the bloodiest of the war, but because of military censorship, Nebraskans didn't learn of their boys' role for more than 2 months. Youngman wrote, "The people back home already know that the regiment paid a heavy price in casualties, but perhaps they will find some consolation in the realization that the heroism and sacrifices of these men have saved the lives of countless other soldiers and materially hastened the progress of the war. The 134th Infantry has set for Nebraska a new standard for courage and gallantry." Youngman later rode into Paris just a few hours after the first Allied troops had liberated the French capital. Youngman later called it the greatest moment of his career. The most dangerous moment came later that day. He witnessed General Charles de Gaulle, commander of the Free French Forces, as he addressed his countrymen in Notre Dame Cathedral. German sniper fire could be heard occasionally during the speech, and Youngman wrote, "History will seldom see a more spectacular display of sheer, cool courage." He was referring to de Gaulle, but keep in mind, Lawrence Youngman stood just a few feet away taking this picture while the bullets were whizzing past. Balancing the joy of liberation was the horror. Lawrence Youngman got a firsthand look at Nazi atrocities and shot photos of a mass grave in the French village where German troops had executed civilians just before leaving. 50 Frenchmen were taken from their homes, lined up and mowed down by machine guns. Simple wooden crosses marked the victims. Months later, Hollis Limprecht, the longtime editor of the World Herald's magazine of the Midlands, was among the troops that liberated the concentration camp at Dachau. Limprecht later wrote of his experience, "I've often wondered since that day, how many human bodies does it take to make a pile 8 feet square and 4.5 feet high? Each of those dozens of bodies that I saw that morning contained the soul of what was not long before a human being, a person with hopes, dreams, desires, and despairs. Imagine the horror, the anger, and the terror of knowing that your death would be at the dictates of another human being who looks upon you as a bug to be squashed." Later, he took some time away from the battlefield and photographed actress Marlena Dietrich, who had performed at a USO show and needed a lift from Nebraska soldiers who carried her over a patch of mud. Youngman also photographed Bing Crosby performing at a brewery in France, but mainly he wrote and photographed the day-to-day existence of American soldiers, digging foxholes, battling the mud. Lawrence Youngman returned home in late 44, and the World Herald sent Bill Bellotti to the Pacific several months later. His first reports came via cable as he traveled on a troop ship on a two-week voyage across the Pacific. First, he described a variety of details of the voyage, including what it was like to shave in rough weather. He also expressed his irritation for a certain correspondent from the East Coast who thought the only purpose of the country's midsection was to act as a barrier so the Japanese couldn't reach Boston. One night, Bellotti wandered below decks, and he wrote of the anonymous nature of the men stacked in the bunks. He admitted to getting a lump in his throat as he thought about what lay ahead for them. Later up on deck, he wrote, "I leaned on the rail and stared into the frothing wake and breathed a silent prayer for every one of them." Bellotti obviously wore his heart on his sleeve, and it came through in his writing time and again. At one point, he provided a lengthy report on heroism by a Nebraska soldier. He quoted the soldier's colonel, who praised him. At the same time, he noted, "The soldier shifted uncomfortably from foot to foot, embarrassed by the praise." During the war's final months, he wrote of the devastating effects the B-29s were having on Japanese cities. These were produced at the Martin plant, of course. A colonel from Connecticut, who had been moved by the story of Boystown, had asked before his final mission that if anything happened to him, that the next B-29 be named after the home for boys in Omaha. The colonel went down in the Pacific, and the next plane was christened the Spirit of Boystown. Bellotti reported that the crew of the Spirit of Boystown would dip the plane's wings every time it passed over the stretch of ocean where the colonel had gone down. Bellotti also brought World Herald readers a glimpse of life at sea during the war. He spent time aboard the USS Benyon, a destroyer that had battled kamikaze planes. These three seamen are from Iowa. They're holding a scorecard of the ship's success. Another crew member, Harold Herskind of Omaha, described a Japanese suicide attack at nighttime. "It hit us amidships, and I thought I was a goner. I hit the deck when I saw it coming, and the next thing I knew, it was over the side, and we were going on with the fight." At the end of the report, Bellotti noted that Herskind had a tattoo on his arm with the name of his wife and two-year-old son. And just as Lawrence Youngman had, Bellotti described the scene of a newly liberated city, this one Manila in the Philippines. He wrote of the Filipino children and how they reminded him of his own little son at home. And he also told of the hope the city somehow would be rebuilt and compared the devastated area to a section of Omaha between Cumming and Q Streets. One of the most fascinating reports came in August when the Enola Gay, also built at the Martin plant, dropped the atomic bomb on Hiroshima. Velotti had heard the rumors of a new secret weapon, and so he decided to interview servicemen who were scheduled to face the prospect of invasion of Japan. One described a previous landing on a Japanese-held island. They shot the hell out of us from every cave, every tree, every darn thing a guy could hide behind. Velotti then asked Omahan Ernest Briley if he thought the Americans' new secret weapon could end the war. Briley replied, "I'm just like everybody else in this theater. I want to get home so bad I'm ready to believe there's a Santa Claus." Well, there was a Santa Claus. And Bill Velotti was later aboard the USS Missouri for Japan's formal surrender. He noted that right behind Douglas MacArthur was General Jonathan Wainwright, who had surrendered at Corregidor 3 years earlier and had spent the last 3 years in a prison camp in Japan. He said tears were in Wainwright's eyes when he was told he was considered a hero back home. He had considered himself a failure. The war, at long last, was over. 8-year-old John Redesia hawked American flags and copies of the World Herald at the corner of 16th and Farnham on VE Day. You might recognize him since he and his family had a newsstand on that corner from 1908 until 1996. I used to buy sporting news from this guy. The scene was far different 3 months later. President Truman announced around dinner time on August 14, 1945, Japan had offered to surrender. The World Herald noted this was it. This was the final amen. Thousands of Omahans immediately flocked downtown. It was time to start welcoming home the troops. More than 50,000 saluted General Butler B. Miltenberger, who had commanded the 134th Regiment that Lawrence Youngman had written about. Miltenberger headed a welcome home parade along 16th Street in Omaha and received a 30-inch key to the city on the courthouse lawn. A similar celebration took place later in his hometown in North Platte. But the welcome homes did not neglect the enlisted man. Assumption Catholic Church in Omaha sponsored a dinner for returned servicemen at the church's parish hall. It was packed. After that, it was time to get back to the routine of life in peacetime. The GI Bill, passed 18 days after D-Day, helped pave the way for returning servicemen to attend college. College enrollment doubled in 1946 to 6.1 million students, and that was a total that wasn't reached again until 1970. Returning servicemen also flocked to veterans centers to look for jobs, and that often meant a long wait for an interview. And while many women left the workforce as the men came home, others continued to work, and in far greater numbers than they had before the war. New veterans' housing benefits created a building boom that led to a new feature in American cities. They called it suburbs. And that housing was immediately put to use as the baby boom was underway. But most of all, the end of the war meant moments like this. The World Herald's Buddy Bunker took this photo in Villisca, Iowa, and won the Pulitzer Prize for photography in 1944. It's become known as the homecoming. One thing that's often overlooked about it is not a face can be seen. Buddy Bunker called it a one-in-a-million shot, and it's often compared to a Norman Rockwell painting. Oddly enough, we had a second photographer there, Harold Cowan, and he snapped a photo at about the same time. But Bunker's was better focused, and that was the one that was used in the paper. The photo was so perfect that there were questions raised about whether it was staged. But in 2008, a home movie found in an attic in Iowa captured the whole sequence on film from the train station to the picture. Included was the moment when the flashbulb popped. There's also a story behind the soldier in this picture. Robert Moore was returning to his hometown of Villisca as a war hero, and that's the reason we had two photographers there. Moore was a member of the Iowa National Guard unit that had been activated into the Army, just like the Nebraskans in the 134th Regiment. His unit saw heavy action in North Africa in 1943. It had been part of an American force that was ill-equipped to handle the seasoned German army there that was under the command of Field Marshal Erwin Rommel, better known as the Desert Fox. Major Moore found himself trapped on top of a mountaintop in Tunisia one night during heavy fighting. An American plane flew over and dropped instructions on where to meet up with friendly forces nearby. The instructions left out one important detail, however. and that was how to get through the German army to get there. Moore knew his 400 men couldn't fight their way out, so he hatched a plan. He had the men sling up their rifles on their shoulders, and they were just going to march down that mountain. They were hoping that the Germans would assume they were German troops, and it worked. Moore earned a commendation and a promotion, and the Americans escaped without casualties. Incidentally, I'm not sure if anyone's ears perked up when I mentioned Villisca, Iowa, but the town is widely known for 8 axe murders that took place there in 1912. There is a connection. Robert Moore's aunt, uncle, and 4 cousins were among the victims of that terrible crime, which was never solved. But I'm guessing you didn't come here to hear about axe murders, so we'll return to the war. I would like to tell you a little postscript on our 2 war correspondents. Lawrence Youngman left the paper in 1946. He said years later that when he got back from the war, nothing else he covered seemed that interesting. He became a highly successful businessman and founded Travel and Transport here in Omaha, which I'm sure you've heard of. Bill Bellotti remained with the paper until retirement in 1975. He specialized in crime and court news, and he loved to tell a good story. "It's been a great life," he said when he retired. "I wouldn't have done anything else." The World Herald collaborated on the Worn with Pride exhibit that was mentioned earlier, and it features memorabilia from our war correspondents, along with famous front pages from different wars. And if you don't mind me name-dropping one more of our correspondents, I have one, Howard Sober, who died in August of this year. Howard was our correspondent in Vietnam, and his work will be featured in our next book, At War, At Home, The Cold War. Should be available very soon. It arrived today, in fact. It follows a 46-year period between the end of World War II and the dissolution of the Strategic Air Command in 1992. Working on that book was an incredible experience. It brought 2 points home to me. First was that the Cold War ended in victory, and I think that's often overlooked. The Iron Curtain was lifted, and it was done without total devastation of nuclear war. And I would argue that navigating this period was among our nation's greatest accomplishments. Second part, something I learned from soliciting memories of those who served during this period, including Korea and Vietnam. And one of them is here tonight, John Dickinson. There you go. These soldiers served as honorably as any other generation, but they were forgotten and never properly thanked. And so I'd like to thank John and any other veterans of the Cold War who are here tonight, including Korea, Vietnam, and the Strategic Air Command. Thank you for your service. The American soldier... Yeah. John also is in the World War II book, by the way. He was a double dipper. The American Soldier exhibit runs through January 6th, and if you haven't spent time with it already, I hope you do so. Worn with Pride runs through February 3rd. Both of our At War at Home books are available upstairs in the museum shop. I'm so grateful for the opportunity to speak to you and be part of the museum's presentation. We obviously have only scratched the surface in World War II tonight. Our book attempts to tell history in a way that supplements what you might have learned in a textbook. But I hope it also provides a reminder of the sacrifice and commitment of the greatest generation. Thank you. I'm ready.
Dan will has a few minutes here for some Q&A if you're so inclined. We do ask Mike, also on the other side, has a microphone that that you do use a microphone, so we'll be glad to get them to you.
Can you tell us what your motivation was for writing the book on World War II?
Well, it's kind of a long story. Our editor wanted to do an at-war, at-home book that highlighted our correspondence over the years. And I was chosen to do that, and I got started looking into the World War II book, and I just said, there's no way we can limit what we have here, and we would have had a 1,000-page book. So I said we just need to do a book on World War II. This material is too valuable to be condensed into a book that covers that large, 70 years, essentially. And that was the motivation. Our archives were incredible. This is all the materials from our archives, and some of the bylines we kept, they were reporters who were still at the World Herald or maybe retired, and we thought people would like seeing their names again with the stories. And that was edited into, so it is more a book form rather than like reading newspaper stories. But that was the motivation. We were pretty proud of what we'd done.
I just wondered, you rely a lot on print media that you have here, and with the decline in print media now, with magazines and newspapers, would someone in the future be able to find the same kind of reliable information that you had?
That's a good question. We're not going out of business, and we will continue to cover the news as we always have. We're online now, and in addition to the paper, and our mission will be continued. We won't stop, and I'm not sure 20 years from now, I'm not sure what form you'll get it in, but we'll still be publishing information on a timely basis. Yes?
Dan, I feel very privileged to have made an acquaintance with Bill and Yvonne Williams, who have done so much for the veterans. They have they were behind the seven honor flights to Washington, D.C., that 750 veterans had the opportunity to go to Washington and see the World War II Memorial plus all the other places in Washington. Bill and Yvonne Williams.
Actually, I had been looking for you guys, and you're kind of hiding there. I would also point out that our book, we have coverage of the honor flights in the book. It was such a tremendous experience for everyone who got to go. And at the same time, part of that, we did what we called Memories of the Greatest Generation, and people sent in their memories. It was part of that same time period, and that's used in the book as well. And I also would like to thank Bill and Yvonne. They helped us with the Cold War Victory Salute this summer, downtown Omaha, and we couldn't have done it without them. They're a tremendous asset to this community.
I really appreciated the At War at Home stories about Afghanistan when you had your reporters embedded there. Are you going to do a book collecting all of those stories?
Yes.
Please.
Yes, we are. The timing on it, we just haven't settled on because, the war isn't over. And that's kind of the, I think our original plan was to have it available next year, but I'm not sure at this point on that. But in answer to your question, yes, absolutely, we are doing that. It'll be Desert Storm, Iraq, and Afghanistan. We won't forget those people. Yep.
Hi, we have two questions about the guard dog training program that you mentioned.
Okay.
do you happen to remember what any of the other seven breeds that they kept using were? And were the dogs raised or recruited? Did they all get them from puppies, or were there dogs that people donated to the program for training?
I think they were donated, but I'm not certain about that. I'm not that well versed on it. I know they had Dobermans, and I remember reading collies, American collies, not border collies, but kind of the farm dog kind of collies. Actually, I didn't bring this photo. There was a photo in the book of the dogs in formation, and they spell out K9. It's kind of, and you can see the different breeds there. There are collies and mutts and everything else in it. Those are the three I remember, though: German Shepherds, Dobermans, and collies.
I would like to add something to that story. I just recently bought a DVD called War Dogs of the Pacific, It's an hour long, and it deals with everything, including the breeds, whether they were donated and what happened after the war. It's one of the best DVDs. It's one of my favorites. So I would say seek that out. It's very entertaining.
I guess I should have put more material on dogs in the book. Huh? Seems a lot of interest.
Could you give us a small description of what this second book is going to be?
Sure, I'd be happy to. It starts in 1946, and we keyed it off Winston Churchill's speech at Westminster College in Missouri, which was the first time that the term Iron Curtain was used. And that was where we started. And the Cold War had a tremendous impact in this area because of the Strategic Air Command. That came to Offutt in 1948. And so we kind of have their... this book is a little different than the World War II book. It's it takes place over a long period. And for a lot of the period, we really didn't have archive material for it because it was just... it's not there aren't a lot of anniversaries. And I hate to admit it, but newspapers like anniversaries, and we do anniversary stories. So we had a lot of Pearl Harbor material and D-Day and things like that. But a lot of the other things, you know, the Cold War major events, we never went back later and looked back at them. And so we started with pretty much the beginning is SAC arriving at Offutt. And then we go to Korea. Actually, one of the most interesting parts is the 1950s. There's a whole, I'm not sure, half generation, if you'd call them, of servicemen during the 50s who did incredible things that no one ever heard about. And we didn't have any archive material because it was top secret. And we solicited their memories in the newspaper, and these guys sent in really incredible stories. And that's they really kind of carry the ball for us through major portions of the book. We did have a correspondent in Vietnam, Howard Silber, and Howard covered Strategic Air Command in Bellevue for a long time. So we do have some material, but these servicemen who sent stuff in, it's amazing. And the guys who were in the 50s, I mean, they're sitting in tanks facing across the border at German tanks. And shots weren't fired, but they were right there. They were on the line, and it's pretty incredible, really. I do have, before I forget, I was looking for Lawrence Youngman's daughter is here tonight. Believe it or not. Oh, there she is, Judy Wigdon. And I thanked her. Her mother kept the most amazing scrapbook of her dad's war experiences. And you wouldn't believe how many hours that saved me just being able to go through that. That way I didn't have to go through our 200 tons of newsprint that was sitting in our library. So anyway, that was it was really a pleasure meeting her tonight.
Well, I just wanted to ask the museum if they have plans or even capacity for any permanent war exhibits.
You know, I'm going to say that I know that it is this project, the Worn with Pride exhibit that we just recently put together here the last year, has brought out a lot of interest. And it has been discussed on what we can do, what some of our options. I will, you know, not in the immediate future. Obviously, there's a lot of variables with that, but we certainly won't. We certainly will look at that very strongly down the road. Last one right here.
My interest was, do you have any information on Rosie the Riveter? They came out with an article in the World Herald about a year ago showing that this was just a happened chance. This young lady was where they were taking pictures, and it's really an interesting story about Rosie the Riveter.
Well, it came out too late for the book, unfortunately. That's we had a lot of Rosie the Riveters here in at the Martin Bomber plant, though. That was that's quite a story in itself. The way women stepped forward to help carry the nation's manufacturing during the war.
Thank you very much, Dan.
No, thank you. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a program from the Durham Museum Lecture Series on Noon Forum. In a special program commemorating the 71st anniversary this Friday of the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor on December 7, 1941, we've heard a talk by Dan Sullivan, the editor for World Herald Books, including At War at Home, World War II, as well as his upcoming book in the At War at Home series that will focus on the Cold War years, including Korea, Vietnam, and the Strategic Air Command. He spoke about the commitment and sacrifice of Nebraskans and Western Iowans who helped the nation defeat the Axis powers. This program, part of The American Soldier from the Civil War to the War in Iraq, a photographic tribute on display now through Sunday, January 6th at the Durham Museum, was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday evening, October 30th, 2012, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Shauna Forsberg, Director of Marketing and Public Relations at the Durham Museum, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. The next program at the Durham Museum will be Tuesday evening, December 18th at 6:30. At that time, Spencer Davis, Professor of History at Peru State College, will present the fourth and final program in his four-part lecture series, The American Civil War, A Look Back 150 Years Ago. His topic will be, Where Do We Go From Here?, October to December 1862. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 200 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.